The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. Well, we have been looking at tapeworms a little bit. One of the unique things about tapeworms is that they don't have a gut, an intestinal tract. I mentioned that they were essentially reproductive sacs that produce eggs. And so the tapeworms simply line the intestinal tract and absorb food material that you or the host has digested for them, and then are able to use that for their energy needs. I mentioned some of the tapeworms last time. I'm not sure going through a set of the names is going to do anything for anybody. Presumably almost any organism can entertain tapeworms on occasion. Humans obviously can. The animals that man uses, cows, sheep, pets, etc., all of these kinds of animals can have tapeworms. One thing that is probably worth reminding you about is simply this. These tapeworms, although they are very similar in some respects, reproductive sacs, no gut, no intestinal apparatus or stomach, and yet there are no reproductive links between them. There's not any common ancestor for them. And I think most evolutionists would try and argue that they had a multi-phyletic origin, that these parasites came from many ancestors, not just one. And that also poses some problems. But I'm simply reminding you that there is no good evolutionary answer as to where all of these parasites have come from. Since that is the case, it exposes one of the major weaknesses of evolutionary arguments. And I'm not sure how much time is worth our time here to go into great detail about this. We could discuss what you can do to prevent them and so on. And if you live in an area where they are a problem, I would suggest you be sure that you take time to do that. Some of the tapeworms, the stages can infect any part of the human body. They can infect brain tissue. They can infect almost any part of the body. These are not considered to be of any major consequence here in our nation for reasons we've talked about. And my comment to you about that is be glad that the processes that have developed as a part of the civilization are very effective in preventing the difficulties that occur in underdeveloped nations, and be aware that folks who live in those nations have tremendous difficulties that we don't even give any thought to. And I think it's important for us to have some empathy for the sorts of difficulties that people in many other areas of the world have that are not difficulties to us. So we've looked at another phylum, the Platyhelminthes, an interesting group. Three very diverse types of organisms in the phylum. Two of them extremely important, flukes and tapeworms. I really don't have a feel for the numbers of people who are killed per year on the earth. I'm sure we're talking about hundreds of millions who die as a direct effect of this, or the parasitized condition sets up difficulties in the body that makes them susceptible to other things as well. And from the standpoint of pain and inability to work, people who have not been in an underdeveloped nation really have no concept of the kinds of problems that these folks have. And I hope this at least will bring some awareness to some if they have not given thought to the types of problems that many people, probably the majority of the people in the world, are at least susceptible to if they do not experience them. The type of climate is really not a matter. Some of these abound in desert country. Some of them are in the tropics. Some are in both. Some live in a variety of different environments. So if you're going to such places, it's well for you to have some understanding of the kinds of difficulties that you're going to find yourself in when you get there, and take some precautions. I did want to make one comment involving the textbook's comments about where these parasites were supposed to have come from. I mentioned this on an earlier program, but I want to go back and talk about a couple of things here. I'm reading now a statement from Hickman's Invertebrate Zoo book. There can be little doubt that the bilaterally symmetrical animals were derived from a radial ancestor, perhaps one very similar to the planular larvae of the cnidarians. Now, we didn't talk about what planular larvae are, but the stages in the life cycle are very different. Some of these stages in the life cycle of some of these flatworm parasites look very much like protozoans. Some of them look like organisms in other phyla. Some of them look like immature stages that are found in other phyla. And certainly before the advent of the microscope, zoologists had some problems. They would go and look at a particular organism and see its similarity to a different organism and decide, well, we'll put these into the same category, when in fact they might have been looking at the immature stages of some of the parasites. And then they would stick it in with mollusk, into the phylum Mollusca, for example. These kinds of difficulties, I think, are pretty much over with, at least those parasites that are important to the human race. Have for the most part had their life cycles determined. In the case of the flukes, the first one was the liver fluke, where all of the life cycles were determined. You say, well, why in the world is that such a problem? Well, if you're going to have the immature stages, the eggs that are excreted from the human body in the intestinal tract with the fecal material, and they are then going to go into the water and hatch into a form which is going to bore into a snail. There will be a further development in the snail's body, and out's going to come another infective stage that's going to be capable of infecting a fish. And then in that body, it goes through another series of developments, and the organism that comes out there is completely different from what the one that went in, but this is the stage that's going to be found that can infect human beings. Then you begin to understand why that determination of the life cycle was very difficult and very troublesome. Finding all of the stages, pursuing these from one host to another, and establishing that particular little peculiar-looking organism in the snail actually was the development from eggs that had been excreted from the human being. This is part of the reason for that difficulty. But with the advent of the microscope and with many of the other tools that are available to us now, that kind of thing has been done. So it's not the problem that it once was. But the fact is, we simply have not found the ancestors, common ancestors, intermediate species, whatever term you want to apply to it. So we've seen a very interesting phylum, a phylum with very differing kinds of organisms in it, both in shape, in structures, in almost any respect you want to look at them, food material, etc. And yet they have sufficient similarities so that they are put together into a single phylum. And we have talked before about the idea that similarities in structure are not necessarily evidence of common ancestors, not necessarily an evidence of relationship. Now, we spent several programs earlier in the series talking at great length about the evolutionist interpretation of homology. There is real homology. Homology is simply a term that means it refers to a similar structures being evidence of some relationship. Now, it is a notorious fact, for example, that children resemble their parents. Well, there's a reason for that. They enjoy a genetic community with their parents. They've gotten genetic material from both the parents, so they're going to look that way. The evolutionist, on the other hand, argues that wherever there is any similarity, that similarity in itself is evidence for relationship. And this is the thing that creationists argue against. We can talk at great length, give hundreds of examples of similarities in very diverse organisms that are not evidence of any relationship, a common ancestor, because reproductive links are simply impossible. Now, where there is a genetic relationship, then you have some basis for arguing that the similarity. But where there is none, trying to argue that this has come from a common ancestor, it in some cases is nonsensical. And the creationist argument here would simply be that God chose to make organisms similar in some regards. They're all here in the same environment. They use the same air, the same water, the same kind of food material. There is no reason for us to suspect that God is somehow going to make all the organisms different, wildly different from one another. And rather than that, he chose structures, processes that work, and simply included those in many of the organisms. So without that genetic relationship, father and mother and offspring, the similarity may not indicate in any way any kind of relationship, and yet the evolutionist argues that this is the case, and in some cases gets himself into all kinds of difficulties because he's chosen that. So would you argue that all anything that has cells had a common ancestor? Well, anything that is cellular in structure is much more similar than anything that isn't. And yet, there ought to be some obvious examples of organisms which have cells but cannot possibly be related. So just keep in your mind the idea that similarity doesn't necessarily serve as a basis for some kind of reproductive relationship or some kind of evolutionary relationship. It may rather simply indicate that God chose to create certain organisms with the same structures, same biochemical processes, etc. And don't fall prey to the idea that simply because there are similarities, this in itself is proof that evolution has occurred.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.